Fox.com studios in Austin, Texas. It's The Real News with your host, David Nutt.
Welcome to Real News. It's Monday, December the 4th, 2017. It was just a week ago that we kicked off our 34-hour broadcast here, Know Your Enemy, Fake News. Well, what's happened in the last week? We have had a flash crash of the stock market based on a totally phony report from ABC. And we've also had, although this hasn't been widely reported, hasn't gotten much attention, we've also had an airstrike on Iran based on a false report by the BBC. So we got the ABC and BBC both coming out here. In just 24 hours, we see the effect of fake news. Very big. Huge. Bigly. A media report, a fake media report, causes the stock market to crash and also causes an airstrike on Iran. Let me tell you about the airstrike in Iran. You know about the crash here in the stock market. People have been talking about that all weekend. And, of course, that was based on the fallacious idea that it was a rumor that was given to an ABC reporter who has now been suspended for 4 weeks without pay. And within a half hour of him reporting that, we had the Dow drop 350 points or more. Now, it hasn't gotten as much attention, but the BBC did something similar within 24 hours of that. This report that they had put out supported an airstrike on Friday that could have pushed us, the United States, into yet another war, reports the Free Thought Project. They reported on Saturday that Israel launched a series of both surface missiles and airstrikes targeting a town near Damascus, Syria. The attack targeted what appeared to be a military base. And they say the existence of the base was apparently revealed less than 1 month ago by a BBC report, which included satellite images of several buildings. And according to the BBC, these images were evidence that, quote, Iran is establishing a permanent military base inside of Syria. However, the entire report was based on information from an anonymous source. Does that sound familiar? Just like ABC. The BBC goes to an anonymous source. They said it was, quote, a Western intelligence source. There was no confirmation as to whether the buildings were being used by Iranian military. And then, as Zero Hedge pointed out, it appears the BBC is playing war propagandists for Israel instead of including any level of critical inquiry. In short, what the BBC did was they spread what they acknowledged to be a mere claim based on an unnamed anonymous source. A Western intelligence source, they said. Then Israel used that claim to attack Syria. Then the BBC, in a circular logic fashion, justified the attack based on its own dubious claim. Self-fulfilling prophecy. This is how we get into things like the Vietnam War, folks. Fake news, fake media, and the government that uses that. We've had some good results over the weekend at the United Nations. Our ambassador, Nikki Haley, who should not be there, clearly should not be there. We can see this in this report. But President Trump overruled her. Nikki Haley wanted the United States to stay into a pro-immigration treaty, a pro-migration treaty. And as Breitbart points out, this is similar to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, where you would have a supranational organization would make decisions about our economy. Which industries are going to be allowed to prosper, which ones were going to be throttled, and we would not have bilateral trade agreements as President Trump wants. And so he shut that down right away. Now, this is essentially the same thing. This is Nikki Haley supporting surrendering U.S. sovereignty to the United Nations. But Trump stopped her. Now he needs to get her out. He should never have put her in there. And as Breitbart points out, if approved by national political leaders, the quote-unquote migration compact from the United Nations would have allowed U.N. bureaucrats and judges to subordinate national laws, such as laws that exclude illegal immigrants, to pro-immigration rules. We'll talk about that more when we come back. Stay with us. We've got a lot of news. We're going to talk about the tax reform changes that have come up over the weekend. What is really in it? And, of course, we're going to talk about what's going on with Mueller, with the Logan Act, with ABC fake news. Stay with us. We'll be right back. John McAfee is going to be joining us to talk about Bitcoin later in the program.
You found it. Live from the InfoWars.com studios in Austin, Texas, it's your host, David Knight.
Welcome back. I'm David Knight on this Monday, December the 4th, 2017. As one report said, it was the best day that President Trump had ever had and the worst day that President Trump had ever had. Actually, that's not true. What came out is simply fake news. This was not something that we didn't know. We knew about this nearly a year ago. This was being discussed just as President Trump was taking office, as he was about to be sworn in. And there was nothing criminal about this. I would say there was nothing even unethical about it. Alan Dershowitz and others were going to have their comments on this. They said, well, you may say that this wasn't a good political move. Maybe you don't agree with the fact that he jumped the gun while we still had a President Obama. You had President Trump and his national security advisor talking to Russia about certain issues, saying, don't panic. I know Obama just put in sanctions. We're not going to do anything about that, or whatever they were saying, trying to stabilize things. Understand that President Trump was trying to hit the ground running. Even Leon Panetta said, there's nothing illegal here. This is really being pushed an absurd extent. Leon Panetta, longtime Democrat congressman. He was also head of the CIA for a short period of time, head of the Defense Department as well. So an Obama administration official, longtime Democrat. There is no crime here, folks. Alan Dershowitz is a Democrat. There is no crime. There is no crime. As Alan Dershowitz said, this is nothing but political jaywalking. And this is something that we knew about. The thing that panicked everybody, or made them so happy, as we'll see with Joy Behar, was the idea, the fake report from ABC News. And they had to take that back. So when we look at what's going on here, there really isn't anything new here. But that wiped out all the good news, the real news, about the tax reform. So the phony fake news completely swamped the real good news. That's the way the game is played. I was talking about it before I get into what was going on with Michael Flynn, the ABC fake news, the way Mueller and others are using this. I want to finish what I was saying about the news at the top of the hour. We had a very important victory that we need to understand, not just the tax victory, but a couple of very important victories. One of them about immigration. It's not just the Trans-Pacific Partnership that sought to control our economy with a transnational bureaucracy that would dictate to us what we could and could not do economically, what our trading partners would be, and what we would be allowed to sell, what we'd be allowed to make. In other words, having our economy managed by a supranational organization, losing our sovereignty. And the UN was trying to do the same thing with immigration. They had a UN migration treaty, heavily supported by our UN ambassador, Nikki Haley. And yet, President Trump did the right thing, even though he did the wrong thing, putting her in the United Nations. He shut her down, just as he eventually shut down Rex Tillerson, who kept pushing for the Paris Climate Agreement. I don't understand why President Trump puts people in these positions who don't share his agenda that he eventually has to shut down, but at least he shut them down. Maybe he's doing it as a political move to disarm the opposition, so they don't try to take him out even more aggressively than they're trying to do. Maybe that's the strategy behind it. But he had to shut down Nikki Haley. And as Breitbart points out, this is the immigration equivalent to what the Trans-Pacific Partnership was trying to do to our economy. Both of them destroying our sovereignty. And here's the bottom line, as I summarize in the article here. If approved by national political leaders, the Migration Compact would have allowed the UN bureaucrats and judges to subordinate our national laws. In other words, destroy our national sovereignty and turn this over to the United Nations. Trump stopped that. As they say, such laws that exclude illegal immigrants, they would shut those down and they would override it with United Nations pro-immigration rules. The treaty would help developing countries to dump much of their fast-growing populations into America's classrooms, where we will have to pay for the schools to the extent that we will not be able to afford a home. And then they'll push us into 200-square-foot apartments in the cities. It would create welfare lines, training classes, workplaces, jails, be filled with these immigrants that we'd be bringing in, helping to establish in the developing countries, helping the establishment to keep power via their divide and rule diversity strategy. That was shut down. That was shut down by President Trump. Good news. Also, pushing back, and this is NPR wringing their hands. Listen to the headlines. Trump to take aim at Utah's national monuments, reversing his predecessor's legacies. You have to understand, we've talked about this many times, how Barack Obama went in and misused an Antiquities Act that was set up to protect Indian artifacts, that was set up to protect things like Devil's Tower, where they would say, this is rare, or these are artifacts, and it was intended to preserve these by coming in, and in the past, what they would do is take the minimum amount. They didn't take millions and millions of acres to preserve Devil's Tower. They preserved the area of Devil's Tower and just a little bit around it. But Barack Obama abused this law, as he did so many others, as he did the National Espionage Act of 1917, to come after more journalists and whistleblowers than every other president over the last 100 years combined. And he did the same thing here with the Antiquities Act. And what he did was, in Utah, he confiscated 1.3 million acres into a Bear's Ears Monument and 1.8 million acres into a Grand Staircase National Monument. And he did a lot of others as well. Those are just a couple of the bigger ones. But he was doing this all over the place, confiscating vast swaths of territory, doing exactly the opposite of what should be done. As the Bundys are pointing out, what should have happened as these territories out west became states, the private land should have been turned over to the states for management, should have been mostly private property. And yes, it could have been preserved. We don't have a wasteland here in Texas. See, it didn't happen here in Texas because Texas was a republic first. The property went into private hands. That's why you have so many millionaires and billionaires here in Texas, is because all this land was not tied up into the federal government's hands. But out west, this all happened after the Civil War. After the Civil War, we had an empire mindset in Washington. And we had a crony capitalism mindset in Washington. We had robber barons and the railroads, and all these people wanted to get their hands on as much wealth as they could and have as much control as they could. That was the whole purpose of the federal government post-Civil War. And so they did not return that land to the states. And what Obama is doing here is accelerating this, and that's what NPR calls his legacy. Well, let's reverse that legacy. Let's get rid of that. There's nothing to be kept. And so they expect that Trump is going to shrink Bear's Ears by up to 85%, that the Grand Staircase Monument, which comes out of the Clinton administration, could be cut in half. My only problem with this is that so often we see a ratcheting effect, don't we? The Democrats come in and they create a new bureaucracy, or they confiscate hundreds of millions of acres of land. And then the Republicans come back and undo a little bit of it. And so you have this ratcheting effect. You never get back to the status quo ante. You never get back to the point of freedom and independence that we had. Instead, you gradually go down this path of control. And even though we repeal this incrementally, you still get there. So that's my concern about this. We also have some interesting movements from Apple. You know, talking about fake news, and we're going to get into this in the next segment. But Apple and Google CEOs went to China. And here's the headline from Bloomberg. Apple, Google CEOs bring their star power as China promotes censorship. And then Tim Cook says, we share China's cyberspace vision. That's right. You want to talk about net neutrality? What a joke. These people have the same mentality as China does in terms of controlling everything that you do. They see it as a public-private partnership. You know, we see that all the time now. PPP, public-private partnership. That's the way we're going to build our roads. It's the way we're going to run our internet infrastructure. You know what it really is? It's another kind of PPP. It's power and profits without principle. That's what they're all about. And these people will sell us down the road working with an authoritarian government, and we can see it happening in China. It will happen here in America if we let it. That is the real threat to our free speech and our freedom of information, not what's going on with the FCC and net neutrality. That is a dodge. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Welcome back on this Monday, December the 4th, 2017. It's just a week ago that we had our 34-hour broadcast, our Know Your Enemy broadcast, where we talked about fake news. And in the last week, as I pointed out at the top of the hour, we have seen a fake news story from ABC, the American Broadcasting Company, and one from the BBC, the British Broadcasting Company. ABC tanked the stock market on the basis of their fake news. The BBC caused a strike in Iran based on fake news, and they went back and referenced their own unsubstantiated report as a reason why the attack occurred, something that could draw us into war. Fake news has real consequences. It's very dangerous, and you need to understand what is happening. It's why they're so desperate to censor InfoWars, and it's one of the reasons that we had the 34-hour broadcast last week. We still have extended these specials that we began last week on Cyber Monday. Here's some of the things that we have. We have 50% off and free shipping on a wide variety of our most popular products, especially some of our heavy and expensive products. We have InfoWars Life Select Survival Food, 50% off plus free shipping. A massive savings, a great time to prepare in these uncertain times. 50% off survival food. That's our food that lasts for, has a shelf life of 25 years. It's all made in America. It is non-GMO. And you can reseal it once you open it. So it has a very, very useful packaging there as well. 50% off plus free shipping. We also have some of our most popular products like Survival Shield X2 Nascent Iodine, Super Male Vitality, Knockout, our all-natural sleep aid. All of those 50% off plus free shipping. We have some big discounts and free shipping on our water filters as well. Alexa Pure, 25% off plus free shipping. Our Alexa Pure Pro Water Filtration Unit, 25% off plus free shipping. And finally, one of the easiest ways to give gifts as we get close to Christmas is with a gift card. You don't have to try to imagine what your friends or family are going to want. And we have something like that here at InfoWars. And if you buy the gift card, you can get 10% off when you buy it with the code BONUS. So a great discount, 10% off when you buy that gift card, something you can give to your friends and family. Helps them, helps InfoWars, and we really do appreciate your support. All right, let's talk about Michael Flynn. There was an interesting story on Russia Insider. I love this headline. I think this nailed it better than anything I've seen. Michael Flynn is the new Martha Stewart. You think Martha Stewart went to jail for insider trading? That's what everybody thinks, right? Just like they, Michael Flynn was colluding with Russians and undermining our U.S. sovereignty. He's a traitor and so forth. No. Just like Martha Stewart, who was not convicted of insider trading, she was convicted of lying to the FBI. That's the important crime. And I had said this on Friday, just before this news broke about Flynn pleading guilty to lying to the FBI. I had said one of the reasons I always believed that they had that tarmac meeting, Comey had already said he was not going to prosecute Hillary Clinton. We now know from the memos. He had already made up his mind even before he interviewed her. But she had to go through this interview, not only with her crony Comey, her homie, but she also had to go this interview with other people present. And she had to be very careful. And she even telegraphed that. She said, you know, you got to be very careful when you talk to the FBI, because the crime of lying to the FBI can be far more serious than the crime that they're talking to you about, the possible crime that they're talking to you about. And we saw that with Martha Stewart, didn't we? And so Bill Clinton talks to the Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, presumably about their grandchildren, which is what he told everybody. Yeah, right. I think it had to do with, well, what kind of questions are we going to be asked? Let's make sure that we've got our answers squared up so that we don't get caught in a lie. I think that's what that was really about. And that's just my conspiracy theory mindset. But I'd been talking about that, and then sure enough, here we come in with Michael Flynn. And this was something that we'd known about since January of last year. It happened 2 months after President Trump had been elected. And this is what Russia Insider says. Says, getting former National Security Advisor Donald Trump, a former National Security Advisor to Donald Trump, Michael Flynn, on a single, quote, lying to the FBI charge, means that after 6 months of investigation, Mueller confirmed what we already knew. Flynn had made a couple of phone calls that he shouldn't have. And I would disagree with that. I would say it doesn't really matter what those phone calls were. And he was already fired by Trump for this. So Michael Flynn will become this decade's Martha Stewart. He'll be used as an example. The media will use him to allow people to vent their frustration with government corruption. Martha Stewart was used that way to make people feel good about sticking it to rich people during the financial crisis. That's exactly what happened, folks. She was a scapegoat. He's going to be a scapegoat as well. It's a tired trope of cultural Marxism. Try people in the court of public opinion to reinforce class division and stereotypes that capitalists are all thieves. In this case, Martha Stewart had made people happy, selling them a traditional lifestyle. Didn't match very well. It conflicted with third wave feminism, so she needed to be destroyed. And she was. Everyone thinks that she was convicted for insider trading, but she was convicted for giving false testimony to the FBI. This is a charge that the FBI gets a 95% conviction rate on because it's very easy for people to misremember details of their life and over the course of multiple interviews to give contradictory statements. Understand, they pull you in, they ask you the question, then somebody asks you the same question the next day, slightly different way. They keep testing you that way. It's an entrapment process. And I had said before, this is process crime. This is what they want. They want to try to get people with process crime. They want to try to then turn them to, and we're going to play a clip from Alan Dershowitz, to either give them some information or to start creating some information to make them happy, to get yourself off the hook. That's the strategy. That's what Mueller is doing. And this is a thoroughly reprehensible way to go about it. As a matter of fact, as I point out, Leon Panetta, a guy who was the defense secretary for President Obama, he had been a CIA director at one point in time, he'd been a longtime Democrat congressman, he said, "We have one administration at a time. Their contact with Russia was very unusual, but whether it breaks the law or not, I think that's probably a stretch." Why was it unusual? Well, we don't usually have presidents who really care about getting anything done, do we? They just want to hold office. They're so happy that they got elected that they spend their time before the election planning all their parties and their inaugural balls and their parades and so forth. Remember that President Trump, well before Thanksgiving, after he had been elected the beginning, the first week of November, within a couple of weeks, he was on the phone to all of these multinational CEOs. And he was getting them to agree to bring jobs back to America. That's what he was doing, hitting the ground running, bringing jobs back to America. That was his number one thing. And he was doing the same thing with Flynn and others, saying, "Hey, let's contact the Russians. Let's tell them, hey, don't worry about these sanctions or whatever. Let's try to make sure that we can ease tensions between the United States and Russia." So he's hitting the ground running. That's what he was doing. That's mindset. Whether or not, I don't think he was giving orders directly to Michael Flynn. Even if he did, it's not a problem. It's only a problem when you compare it to the do-nothing preeners who typically get elected into politics. They don't care about anything except holding office and having parties. Trump was trying to get something done. No law was violated. When we come back, I want to break down what this really is with the help of Monty Python. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Now, I just talked about how the analogy for Michael Flynn was Martha Stewart, who did not go to jail for insider trading. She was somebody who had to be taken down, but they took her down for lying to the FBI. Same thing they're doing to Michael Flynn. But I think there's another analogy that we can use here to get people to understand this. We were talking about this. My son and I were talking about it, and we were laughing about it being like the Monty Python Bridge of Death. And I know it's a tragedy, personal tragedy for Michael Flynn. I'm not laughing about that. I'm laughing about the absurdity of what the mainstream media and the political establishment are doing here. Now, you remember Monty Python's Holy Grail? And as they come up to the Bridge of Death, they have to answer three questions or they get catapulted into the Bridge of Death. If they answer the three questions, they get across. And here's let's run this first clip, just introduce the concept.
Here's the keeper of the Bridge of Death. He asks each traveler three questions. He who answers the three questions, may cross in safety.
But what if you get a question wrong?
Then you are cast into the gorge of eternal peril.
Okay, and so they're like, okay, who's going to go first? Well, the brave guy is Sir Lancelot. And he decides he's going to go out and just take this guy out. He's going to attack him. They go, no. Let's do it the other way. So, all right, I'll go up and I'll answer his questions. Okay? This is like going before the FBI. So he walks up and he gets kind of Hillary Clinton questions. It's like, here's the three questions. What's your name? He gives him his name. What's your quest? I seek the Holy Grail. What's your favorite color? Blue. All right, you can go. It's like, that's it? That's it? And so one of the guys with King Arthur takes a look at it. He goes, oh, that's easy. Let's roll that clip.
That's easy.
Stop. Who approacheth the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other
really
side
cocky,
he sees.
This guy is.
Ask me the questions, Bridgekeeper. I'm not afraid.
What is your name?
Sir Robin of Camelot.
What is your quest?
To seek the Holy Grail.
What is the capital of Assyria?
I don't know that.
Would that be Aleppo? I don't know. Is that Aleppo? That's what happened to Gary Johnson.
Stop. What is your name?
Sir Galahad of Camelot.
What is your quest?
I seek the Grail.
What is your favorite color?
Blue. No.
That's the process crime that the FBI has. Yeah, asking the same simple questions that he had asked Lancelot. You know, last one, what's your favorite color? And a little bit of indecision or contradiction, that's it. You get cast into the gorge of eternal peril, or a federal penitentiary, if you wish. That's the way the FBI works. That's what this is all about. That's what a process crime really is. You keep asking the same questions until you get some uncertainty or until you get a contradiction, and then you cast the guy into the gorge of eternal peril. Now, here's what needs to happen to these politicized special prosecutors, Mueller and the rest of them, as we saw this corruption over the weekend. They've got their own problem, don't they, now? Let's play the last part of this, because this is now the king's turn to answer the question. And watch this interrogation back and forth.
Stop! What is your name?
It is Arthur, King of the Britons.
What is your quest?
To seek the Holy Grail.
What is the airspeed velocity of an unladen swallow?
What do you mean? An African or European swallow?
Huh? I don't know that.
And the questioner, the FBI, gets cast into the gorge of eternal peril. That's what really should happen. Turn this around on these people. Why are we going through this exercise anyway? Should have just had Lancelot take the guy out. But that's what really is going on with this. And that's the way that we need to shut this thing down. Turn this back around on the guy. This is a charade. It's a farce. It's a little play, just like the movie that you saw there. Here's what Alan Dershowitz had to say. He believes that it is a show of weakness for Mueller to have to settle for something that we've known all along. And he has some other interesting comments. Here's Alan Dershowitz, who is a Harvard law professor, longtime Democrat, on Fox News Channel's Fox and Friends.
Well, the last thing any prosecutor wants to do is to have to indict his primary witness for lying. Because if you indict your witness for lying, it really means he's not useful as a witness. He has no credibility.
Hold that right there. This is like Monty Python absurdity, isn't it? Well, the last thing you want to do is have to indict your primary witness for lying, because now you've destroyed his credibility. I mean, this is like the absurdity illustrated by Monty Python. Let's go ahead with what else Alan Dershowitz has to say.
Sure, the prosecutor was trying to indict him for some scheme or conspiracy that involved other people in the White House, but there is nothing there. And he had to finally come down and indict him for lying, which makes him a useless witness. So this is not a show of strength by the prosecutor. It's a show of weakness. It's a show that they really have nothing on anybody above a Flynn.
That's right.
And that Flynn made the terrible mistake about lying about something he could have told the truth about. Because the two things he lied about were perfectly lawful, perfectly proper for somebody to do during the transition. And so I think it really reflects the weakness, not a strength, in Mueller's prosecution.
Professor.
So what he's saying is that they caught him lying about something that was really inconsequential. It was legal. It didn't matter. But you lie to the FBI, even if it's about your favorite color, and they cast you in the gorge of eternal peril or a federal penitentiary. And he went on to say, you get people as part of this process crime. Alan Dershowitz went on. You get them for failing to fill out the proper paperwork or forms. It's like political jaywalking. And that's what this is. It is political jaywalking. Real serious consequences for General Flynn, and serious consequences for the United States as well, because he would have been a great national security advisor, I believe. He was a guy of great integrity and candor. He had blown the whistle on unlawful actions by the Obama administration. It was a shame to lose him. But when we go back and look at this, Trump was aware of the fact that they had caught him in a lie. Also, Vice President Pence. And they had to get rid of him. And they did get rid of him. And that basically cut off any problem with President Trump that could be imagined, even though he had not committed a crime. I mean, quite frankly, you could say that Trump could have been safe in terms of standing behind him. But it was early in the administration. They knew they were gunning for them. And that's why he had such a short tenure there. But it is a shame that they have won, that they got him thrown out for political jaywalking, and then they're going to throw the book at him as well. It's not going to be a simple fine. They're going to put him in jail for a certain period of time just to make their point, like they did with Martha Stewart. Trump says that Michael Flynn's actions during the transition were lawful and there was nothing to hide. He says it's a shame because his actions during the transition didn't reflect any problem. And he attacked in tweets over the weekend. He attacked the FBI for destroying Michael Flynn's life, exactly, by prosecuting him and asking why nothing ever happened to Crooked Hillary. Well, that's a rhetorical question, isn't it? We all know why nothing happens to Hillary. No matter how many crimes she is guilty of, and we had that, that's still one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life. FBI Director Comey laying out the federal violations of law that she had made in terms of national security. And I looked at my wife and I said, he's going to indict her. I mean, he's talking about all the laws that she broke. And then he comes out and says, but it doesn't serve our interest to put her in jail. But don't you try this at home. And it's like, wow, wow, I cannot believe that. And this is what President Trump said over the weekend in tweets. He says, so General Flynn lies to the FBI and his life is destroyed while Crooked Hillary Clinton, on that now famous FBI holiday, quote unquote, interrogation with no swearing in, no recording, lies many times, nothing happens to her. Rigged system or just a double standard? He said many people in our country are asking what the, quote unquote, Justice Department is going to do after the fact that totally crooked Hillary, after receiving a subpoena from the U.S. Congress, deleted and acid washed 33,000 emails. No justice. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm David Knight on this Monday, December the 4th, 2017. Fake news has big consequences. We've been talking about this throughout the hour. Of course, it tanked the stock market, 350 points, based on Brian Ross's fake news on ABC. Only took about a half hour for that to happen. After the tax plan passed the Senate, of course, it still has to be reconciled. And we're going to talk about that. We're not going to let the establishment media and the Democrat politicians pushed the tax reform news out of the headlines here as they are doing on mainstream media. But I do want to push back on what they actually did over the weekend. That's why we've gone to this. And let's not forget that we had a big victory, not just with tax reform, but also in shutting down something most people didn't know was happening. And that was a push by the UN to dictate what our immigration policies would be. That was something that our UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, pushed very hard to support, just as our Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, pushed to keep us in the Paris Climate Agreement. And President Trump pushed back against both of them. He did the right thing. He shut down Nikki Haley. He shut down the UN's power grab over our sovereignty on immigration policy. So I want to talk about the fake news aspect of it. Interestingly enough, the Dow Jones is up 200 points today based on reality after it dropped 350 points based on ABC fake news last week. President Trump weighed in on that. We'll tell you what he had to say in just a moment. Real quickly, I want to remind you of the sales that we still have from our 34-hour broadcast last Cyber Monday. We have 50% off a wide variety of products, things like Living Defense, Prostaguard, Brain Force Plus, Super Male Vitality, Knockout, our all-natural sleep aid, Survival Shield X2, our nascent iodine, all those. 50% off plus free shipping. And you can also get a gift card at InfoWars. If you use the code word bonus when you're buying the gift card, you can save 10%. You can give that to your friends and family and spread the news about InfoWars, as well as saving 10% on a gift card right now. Great time to do that coming up to Christmas. So we thank you for your support. Look at all the specials. There's many, many more besides what I just read. Even Silver Bullet, colloidal silver, 67% off plus free shipping. Take a look at the sales at InfoWarsStore.com, and we appreciate your support. Let's take a look at what happened now with the flash crash and so forth. And just to go back and remind you, we had the flash crash, but think about what happened a year ago. Breitbart went back and did an article based on Jack Posobiec pointing out that the Obama administration, back on January 13th, said that there really wasn't anything inappropriate about contact between members of the incoming administration and foreign officials. This is what President Trump was talking about. No crime was committed. It's like asking him what his favorite color is. And the government knows with the NSA what your favorite color is. That's the other thing that's scary about this. Civil libertarians ought to be looking at this. Anybody who is interested in freedom and privacy should be interested in what happened, those aspects of what happened to General Flynn. But as they pointed out, and they put the transcript of this press conference on January 13th last year, and the Breitbart article had a reporter say, report starting yesterday, but then more of them this morning about contact between the incoming National Security Advisor and the Russian ambassador. I'm just wondering, from the State Department's point of view, is this something that is of concern at all? Or I'll just leave it there and then follow up. And the State Department official, Toner, said, again, not necessarily. I've seen the reports. I don't think they've been confirmed or corroborated yet, but that's, as part of the transition team, that's really for them to speak to and how they are engaging. In other words, it's not a crime. It is not a crime. But it was something that individuals got very, very excited about. You had Joy Behar. Her joy was overflowing. She was giddy as she read the fake news from ABC. She said, Michael Flynn promised full cooperation to the Mueller team and is prepared to testify that as a candidate, Donald Trump directed him to make contact with the Russians as a candidate. See? And she goes, yay, wow, he goes to jail, he goes to jail, he goes to jail, lock him up. And the audience is cheering and applause. This is the antithesis of election night. On election night, I had to, wear a veil. I was in mourning. Well, I think you need to get that out of storage again, Joy, because what you did was you bought into a false report. There is no joy for Behar today. No, it isn't. Let's take a look at what even CNN had to say as they dumped down on their fake news competition, ABC.
The thing that baffles me about this is why would it take ABC News hours to correct this when every other media outlet was right? Also, and I'm going to be very blunt about this, I'm sorry, this is not Brian Ross's first mistake in reporting breaking news inaccurately, linking Saddam to the anthrax attacks in 2001, linking the Aurora shooter to a Tea Party by using the wrong name. ABC should have been on notice. Anytime there's breaking news and special events, you run the risk of misreporting.
That's right, especially if you use anonymous sources, as the Washington Post loves to. And as he pointed out, this went on for hours. Donald Trump Jr. trolled ABC. And he says, ABC retracts their misleading quote-unquote bombshell and removes their tweet approximately 12 hours. 12 hours after they knew it to be false. And then he said this. This is Donald Trump Jr. to ABC. I know it's rare for you guys to get more than 200 retweets, so I guess you milk it when you can, right? Oh, there you go. And Joy Behar is having a hard day, isn't she? Joy Behar. And when you look at what happens, as Matt Drudge put out there, the daily poll from Gallup, Trump approval. And you see that even though they get these tax cuts pushed through the Senate, it's the fake news from ABC that causes President Trump's job approval to plummet on the same day that he has a big victory for real. The fake news takes it down. That's the way the news cycle works. President Trump said people should sue ABC for the stock market crash. He said people who lost money when the stock market went down 350 points based on false and dishonest reporting of Brian Ross of ABC, he's been suspended. He says should consider hiring a lawyer and suing ABC for damages this bad reporting has caused. Many millions of dollars lost. And then he goes on to congratulate in a later tweet, congratulations to ABC News for suspending Brian Ross for his horrendously inaccurate, dishonest report on Russia. Russia, Russia, witch hunt. That's exactly what it is. But the Democrats are still coming. They are not deterred in this. So you got Feinstein on impeachment. My concern about Trump's ability to do his job rises every day. And this report from left-wing Politico. White House is paranoid. Quote, everyone thinks they're being recorded. Well, you are. Get that clip from Michael Hayden. You are being watched. It's not just the White House, but it's especially the White House. Especially the White House is being watched. Remember what Michael Hayden, former director of the NSA, former head of the CIA, bragging to students at Washington and Lee. And this is what he had to say.
This is not about guilt. In fact, let me be really clear, okay? NSA doesn't just listen to bad people. NSA listens to interesting people. People.
What a disgusting individual. And when you look at him, just go back. If you've never seen, we're talking about Monty Python and all those guys. Go back and look at Brazil. And Michael Hayden looks like the torturer and interrogator that would wear the baby masks when they would torture people. That's what this guy looks like as he's torturing the Constitution, as he's destroying our Bill of Rights and our privacy. And Zero Hedge has an article that says, what the media isn't telling you about the indictment of Michael Flynn. He says the case should alarm anybody who is concerned about civil liberties. Obama administration holdovers at the Justice Department concocted an unorthodox legal rationale for subjecting Flynn to an FBI interrogation 4 days after he took office. They tested his recollection of conversations. Now we're back to the bridge of death, right? Flynn was being quizzed on his precise recollection of the conversations, and he was nailed for lying when his recollections deviated from the transcripts. Ah, the transcripts. Where did the transcripts come? They came from the dragnet surveillance. And that's the real story that nobody wants to talk about. The fact that we have a politicized surveillance agency that is focused on interesting people. People like presidential candidates that they don't control. Last week, we talked to William Binney on the program. And he said, what you need to understand is that the national surveillance community has become a Praetorian Guard. Remember what happened with the Praetorian Guard? They were originally there to protect a certain emperor or whatever, but then they became the ones who made those in power. And that's what is happening. And the guy who spent decades working for the National Security Agency, who became a whistleblower because he supports the Constitution, is warning us what is happening. And we can see this. They had the transcripts. That's how they would know what his favorite color is and cast him into prison if he gives them an inconsistent answer. All this came from Sally Yates. We'll be right back. I'm David Knight. Stay with us.
Powers, keep on lying. Live from Austin, Texas, it's David Knight.
Keep on dying. Welcome back. Well, it's vaccine fever. This time in the Philippines. The Philippines are launching a probe into a vaccine against dengue fever. They've launched an investigation in the immunization of 730,000 children with a dengue vaccine that could pose health risks. Last week, a French drug company Sanofi announced its vaccine could, quote, worsen the potentially deadly disease in people who were not previously infected. Think about that. It could worsen it in people who were not previously infected. In other words, it's not effective, but it's also dangerous. Understand? We're seeing this over and over again from vaccines, aren't we? Doesn't really provide you any immunity, but it can kill you. And they have reports that they're still investigating as to whether or not three children have died from this vaccine. This is the first ever approved vaccine for dengue fever. In addition to the Philippines, this French company is also selling it in Argentina, Australia, Bangladesh, Bolivia, Brazil, Cambodia, Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Indonesia, Malaysia, Mexico, Paraguay, Peru, Singapore, Thailand, and Venezuela. There we go. It's also been used in a public immunization program in Brazil, which combined with the Philippines scheme has to date provided around 1 million people with at least one dose of the drug. And they said, as far as we know, as far as we're made aware, a lot of qualifications here, right? There are no reported deaths related to this vaccine. That's a pretty low standard, isn't it? And yet there are some people who are saying three children have died. And now they're investigating that. They say that this vaccine is called Dengvaxia. Oh, great. That's wonderful. It worked, quote unquote, worked with people who had had a prior infection, but it posed a risk for those who hadn't. So let me ask you this. For the people who had a prior infection and had recovered, do you think it was their natural antibodies that worked, or was it this vaccine? And then the vaccine causes potential health problems, serious potential health problems, including risk of death. For those not previously infected by dengue virus, the analysis found that in the longer term, more cases of severe disease could occur following vaccination upon a subsequent dengue infection. In other words, it actually made it worse. If you had not been exposed to dengue fever in a natural way and achieved natural immunity, then what would happen is if you did get real dengue fever, this vaccine would make you worse, make you worse. A non-governmental organization said that it had received information that three children who were vaccinated with Dengvaxia had died. And a senator said that he was aware of two cases. This is being reported from Reuters. We will leave no stone unturned in making those responsible for this shameless public health scam, which puts hundreds of thousands of young lives at risk accountable, says a spokesperson for the Philippine government. Instead of doing what we did here in America, which is to give them legal immunity as they expose us to unmitigated risks. We can't not get any kind of compensation from them, as we have talked to Del Bigtree several times, the producer of the film Vaxxed. You should be aware of what happened in the mid-80s. The vaccine companies were given immunity, legal immunity, and the government became their guardian, protecting them from people making charges and saying, at taxpayer expense, we will compensate certain individuals, but you'll have to go through these levels to prove your damage, and we won't do any studies to evaluate the safety or the efficacy of these vaccines. That will be up to you. And, of course, we're not going to let you see anything that we have. We're not even going to do the studies. And one of the individuals here who was the former health secretary said, in the event that there will be authorities who point culpability to me, I'm ready to face the consequences. We implemented it in accordance with the WHO, the World Health Organization, guidance and recommendations. There you go. Plausible immunity. Just as they say here. But it was rubber stamped as being okay by the CDC, who sells vaccines themselves. It was okay by the Department of Health and Human Services. They cover for the vaccine agencies. And now you've got somebody in the Philippines, even though they can't say the Philippine government said it, they said, but it was the UN that said, the World Health Organization. We're okay with that. Stay by this. We'll be right back. We're going to talk about tax reform. What is it? What's going on with it? We'll be right back.
You found it. It's the real. From the Infowars.com studios in Austin, Texas, it's your host, David Knight.
Welcome back. I'm David Knight, and we've spent the last hour debunking what did not happen last week. We did not have an indictment that is going to lead to an impeachment of President Trump. They're going to keep trying. Don't worry. They're going to keep up with these political jaywalking schemes. They're going to keep up with trying to get process crimes on people, throwing those around President Trump into jail. But what came out with ABC News, even though it crashed the stock market, is not what happened. Let's talk about what really happened that they completely swamped with the fake news. And that is the deal on tax reforms. Now, this went through the Senate. This is the big hurdle that they had to get through in the Senate. And, of course, Bob Corker opposed it all the way through and continued to vote against it. Bob Corker, Exhibit A of why we need to get people like him and the GOP establishment out, why it's so important to win in Alabama for the conservatives, for the Tea Party groups to win, to get people like Bob Corker out. When Roy Moore defeated their lobbyist, Luther Strange, the puppet of Mitch McConnell, even though they'd spent $30 million to defeat him in the primary and spent a lot of money to defeat the other conservative there, Mo Brooks, as well, so they could keep Luther Strange going. Once they defeated Luther Strange in the primary, Bob Corker the very next day said, I'm not running again. And if Judge Roy Moore wins, after all the dirt and lies that they have thrown at him, you're going to see some more of these swamp creatures grabbing their hoard of money and running for their lair. And that's what Bob Corker was doing. But let's take a look at Elizabeth Warren. She was very, very upset about the fact that there were handwritten additions to the Senate tax plan. And she gets into full schoolmarm mode, which you have to listen to this and watch this. This is Elizabeth Warren very upset about the fact that she got this with some handwritten annotations on it. Here she is.
So here it is Friday night, and I just want to give you an idea of how the Republican leadership thinks we're supposed to make laws in the United States Senate. They have just released the tax bill. It is about 500 pages, and they want us to vote on this thing in about an hour. An hour. I spent more than an hour making a decision about the refrigerator that we recently bought.
Well, that's why you shouldn't be senator.
Republicans think that they can cram through a tax bill that will affect every family in America, that will touch every business in America, and they can do it by
and
just
lower our taxes.
Jamming
touch us in a good way.
A bunch of paper and telling everybody to go vote on it. Here's what else
they've
done.
She's going to show us the handwriting.
They're sending
she's
around
gonna,
their
she's going to grade the Republicans.
As
look at this.
We speak.
They wrote in the margins. I'm going to have to get my red pen out.
Let's just give you one here. Section 13543, modification of treatment of S corporations.
Okay, that's enough of her. I can't take any more of Elizabeth Warren, Pocahontas. Getting on her schoolmarm and grading the Republicans. She's going to complain about what they wrote down in the margins by hand. Well, let's talk about Tim Scott. Let's go to video clip number one. Because he was asked on CNN by fake Jake Tapper about this very charge, which is coming out from many Democrats. We've got another Democrat talking about this as well. But let's go to Tim Scott, Republican senator from South Carolina, and he takes this on. Here we go.
I'm old enough to remember the 86 tax cut bill. It took 15 months. I'm just wondering, I mean,
because
just
of Democrat opposition.
As a simple yes or no, I mean, was this the process that you had hoped for to have all these changes made at the last minute?
Well, Jake, I'll say it this way. The last hearing that we had was a 23-hour hearing. We had 63 Democrat amendments that were offered. The suggestion that this was not done in the light of day and the last-minute changes as they talk about them were last-minute changes that had been envisioned for weeks. We knew at the end that there would be dials that were changed. So here's an example. We increased helping small businesses by about 2.4%. That happened in the last hour or so, but that had been envisioned for the last 10 days because we had been talking about that. So we had another amendment by Senator Rubio to increase the child tax credit. Had that happened on the floor, that would have been a last minute change, but that was something else that had been envisioned. So there were no new ideas, no new opportunities, simply opportunities that had been envisioned that were going to be voted yes or no on the floor and then fused into the final product. The suggestion that we had so little time to take a look at 500 pages is inconsistent with truth.
Exactly. What he's saying is that these are all items that have been discussed, that have been debated, and at the last minute they come in and they say, all right, well, let's do that that particular tax rate? Are we going to do this tax rate or that tax rate or whatever? These are all items that have been debated extensively, and then they wrote them in at the last minute. Let's go to the Democrat, John Tester, who's also very testy about the handwritten stuff. This is the Democrat talking point here that they've got, not whether or not that we should have tax reduction. They will never give you tax reduction. So they'll always complain about the process. Here he is.
Hey, happy holidays, everybody. It's the night we're going to be voting on the tax bill. I just got the tax bill 25 minutes ago.
Did you know that they were going to be voting on it?
Wow. See how thick it is? That's what it looks like. Oh, no, let's look at the bill. This is what it really looks like. I want you to take a look at this, folks. This is your government at work. Here's the bill as it's written. Here's the modifications that are in it. I can read one word. It's called add this language. Can you tell me what that word is?
Okay, I'm going to have to get out that red marking pen from Pocahontas and mark that down. He doesn't like the handwriting there. That's enough of this guy. You know, let's just understand that we want to get our taxes cut. And I don't care how you guys do it. You want to stall and stall and stall. And then after people have been talking about all these different approaches and different items and whether you're going to put this in or take that out, and then at the last minute they write it in by hand because they're still negotiating it up to the very last minute. And then all they're left to talk about, Pocahontas, the school marm, and this guy, John Tester, getting testy about the handwriting. Okay, fine. You didn't do that with Obamacare, right? And we now see the results of this. We've seen the stock market, the Dow Jones Industrial, going up 200 points after it was tanked by ABC's fake news. Now people are starting to take a look at what's really going on. And we don't really know what is going to happen with it because it still has to be reconciled with the House bill. We do know that it's going to go through, and we do know that most of this is a good thing in terms of cutting taxes. Anytime taxes are cut, it's a good thing. And as Goldman Sachs is looking at it, they ascribe a 90% probability the legislation becomes law by the end of the year. They said, we expect the final structure of the bill to reflect more the Senate bill than the House bill, including a 20% corporate tax rate effective 2019. That's not a good thing. We should have that retroactive to 2017. That is delaying it by 2 years, delaying it until after the election. The Senate's more restrictive limit on net interest deductibility and the Senate's treatment of pass-through income. Again, underscoring the need to get rid of the GOP establishment uni party. Some of these guys, like McCain and others, came in because they said, all right, we're not going to give anybody any tax relief for another 2 years. All right, I can sign on to that. It's going to be tough, but I can do it. But Bob Corker wouldn't even sign on to that, not even to that. And so he was trying to get this trigger in, and that would trigger tax increases, complaining about the fact there was going to be $1 trillion added over 10 years when he had no complaints about Barack Obama adding about $250 billion per year over the last 8 years. Where was he? That's why I called him a chicken hawk, a deficit chicken hawk. But this, I think, is the real key here. Zero Hedge says that Trump's tax cut is a masterpiece of politics. He said FBR would be envious. He said Democratic leadership understand the triple whammy of eliminating the state and local tax exemption, lowering corporate tax rates to 20%, and incentivizing the onshoring of corporate profits held overseas will gut their support at the Electoral College level. Why? And they pointed out this way. They say the incentives are now aligned to accelerate the exodus of workers and businesses from high-tax, high-regulation states like New York, New Jersey, Illinois, and California to low-tax, lower-regulation states like Florida, Georgia, Tennessee, and Texas. In other words, the blue wall will crumble. Boom! Whether or not you like the taxes, whether or not it saves money, it's going to destroy the Democrats. It's going to make people leave their state, and it's going to cost them even more in the Electoral College. Stay with us. We'll be right back with John McAfee talking about Bitcoin. Welcome back. I'm David Knight, and we're going to be talking to John McAfee in this segment. We're going to talk to him about Bitcoin. He's made some amazing predictions and put out a wager that has everybody talking about it. So we want to talk to him about what's going on with it. Some new updates today. We've had the United Kingdom saying that they are planning regulatory crackdown on cryptocurrencies. That's the rumor. Created a bit of a bump in the price of Bitcoin over the weekend. So I want to talk to him about that, talk to him about the basis of his predictions. And, of course, John McAfee is heavily involved in cryptocurrencies himself, having been a pioneer in antivirus software. He's now a pioneer in Bitcoins and in Bitcoin mining. And so we're going to go to him in just one moment. Before we do, real quickly, I want to remind you of the sales that we have at InfoWarsStore.com. 50% off or more on many of our most popular products, as well as free shipping. It's a great time to try new products, to stock up on products that you use on a regular basis. InfoWars Life Select Survival Food is now 50% off, plus free shipping. Massive savings on that, as well as some other high-ticket items like Alexa Pure Pro Water Filtration Unit, 25% off, plus free shipping. All ProPure items, 25% off, plus free shipping. And then in terms of health products, we have things like Living Defense, Prostaguard, Brain Force Plus, Super Male Vitality, Survival Shield X2 Nascent Iodine, Knockout, all those, 50% off plus free shipping. Many others, even Silver Bullet, 67% off plus free shipping. Take a look at the sales that we have at InfoWarsStore.com. We really do appreciate your support. That's what keeps this operation going. All right, let's go to John McAfee now. And, of course, you can find John McAfee on whoismcafee.com. His Twitter is at Official McAfee. Thank you for joining us, John.
Well, you're very welcome. I'm always happy to be on your show.
Well, thank you. And it's always interesting to talk to you, especially now that you have upped the ante on your bet. You famously said that you would eat a certain part of your anatomy if Bitcoin failed to get to $500,000 by 2020, and you said that this summer, and I had you on. We talked about that briefly at the time.
Yes.
Now you have up that to $1 million because it's rising even faster than you'd anticipate. What did you base this on? What assumptions and what kind of, give us an idea of what kind of analysis you used. Was this something that you did mathematically, or is this just a gut feeling that you have?
No, I am a math major, and mathematics is my business. I'm a programmer. It was based on some very simple assumptions. There can only be 21 million Bitcoins. That's the max. 4 million of them have already been lost. So now we're down to 17 million. Hmm. And we have the entire world that will be potential users. Now, when I made that prediction, I also predicted that it would be $5,000 before the end of 2017. Well, it almost peaked at $12,000 today. So Clearly my assumptions were way off. Now, I will not have to eat that part of my anatomy, I can assure you. I am perfectly safe at $1 million at the end of 2020. See, here's the problem. Everybody is making predictions based on the old paradigm of investment and and growth, where 10% is astonishing. But we get 20% a day. Consistently, sometimes with some cryptocurrencies. Why? Because the supply is limited. We can't print anymore. Like, you can print more US dollars, you can print more British pounds, you can print more Japanese yen. You cannot create any more Bitcoins, and the maximum of 21 million. Now, if you take 21 million coins, and let's say only half of the world ends up using Bitcoins, well, we've got 2.5 billion people using 21 million coins. Please just use your head. $1 million is nothing in 3 years, if I am correct. And I am correct. I don't make bets and lose them. This is, my wife can tell you that. She's holding the phone here. it's an easy bet. It's something I can absolutely guarantee. Now, since I said that, a bunch of people have jumped on the bandwagon, okay? why? Because I said it. And I stand by it. And Bitcoin is accelerating in its value.
Yeah, we've got a lot of people that are saying that they expect by the end of next year, quite a few people said $40,000, $50,000. You're probably even higher than that in your estimation if it's going to get to a million by 2020. They're saying $40,000, $50,000 by the end of 2018 is what many people are expecting now.
No, my figure is at 78,000 by the end of 2018. However, what astonishes me is people say, we think Bitcoin is going to be 14,000 by the end of 2018. What paradigm are they using? They are using the old paradigm where you do have bubbles, where things do pop, where you do have corrections. The word correction cannot be applied to Bitcoin. That's from an old paradigm.
Well, I want to talk to you about some of the stuff that is coming out. There's a couple of things that I want to hit with you. One of them is as somebody who is a who's been there from the beginning in terms of cybersecurity. I want to talk to you about just tips that you would tell people in terms of how to protect themselves against cyber theft. We'll get to that in a moment. But the other part of this, besides the limited number of coins that are there that are fixed in this algorithm, is the fact that it is being pushed back against by many governments. We now have the UK saying we're going to come in with a regulatory crackdown. We've already seen it in China. You're in Asia as well. You were there, and we saw what happened with that. Many different ways that you have central banks and governments trying to attack. Many people believe that there was a direct denial of service launched against, say, Coinbase and their trading site last week that caused that flash crash from about 11,000 down to 8,500, but then it recovered. And we've seen the same type of thing coming from Jamie Dimon and the world's biggest hedge fund manager, both attacking Bitcoin. That happened just before I talked to you the last time, and that had taken Bitcoin down from $4,000 to $3,000, but then it recovered and lost about a quarter of its value, but then it recovered in just a few days. So we got these attacks coming from the central bankers, from the investors, from the regular bank industry, as well as governments coming in to try to regulate this, but then still in China, it's still going strong. People don't realize how strong it is in Asia. That's why you're in Asia, right? And I know you got a cold. I thank you for joining us. We were going to have you on Friday, and you were very sick with the flu, so I really appreciate you coming on today.
So here's the problem. It does not matter whether governments like Bitcoin or not, whether banks like Bitcoin or not. I was on with Jamie Dimon when he was saying Bitcoin was a fraud. Well, it's clearly not. Jamie Dimon is head of America's largest bank. Obviously, he's frightened. All banks are frightened. In 5 years' time, we will have no banks because everybody with a Bitcoin wallet will be its own bank. I can do wire transfers or the equivalent. I can do the equivalent of writing checks. Everything that a bank can do, my wallet can do. And this is the problem. Banks are looking at coin exchanges now. I have developed, in conjunction with Bit India in India, a wallet which is distributed. You cannot shut it down.
Hang on, we got to take a quick break, and we're going to be right back to you. And I want to talk about the wallets and how these people are trying to attack us. And of course, you know, they came after Ross Ulbricht. That was one of the key things that they came after him for, was because he was using Bitcoin. In the early days, very early adopter of it, they saw that as a threat. They do see it as a threat. Stay with us. We'll be right back with John McAfee.
Universal deceit. Telling the truth is a revolutionary act. And now, your host, David Knight.
Welcome back. I'm David Knight, and we're talking to John McAfee specifically about Bitcoin. Because John McAfee is a pioneer now, and has been for a while in cyber currencies as well as in Bitcoin mining. He was a pioneer decades ago in terms of virus protection software. So I want to talk to John about what is going on. Of course, we talked in the last segment about his prediction of Bitcoin increasing, why he was confident of that. Says he had come about that by a mathematical analysis, not just a gut feeling. And when we look, John, at what's happening here, this is something that is a global phenomenon. You're in Asia right now because that's really where the demand is the biggest. People don't realize that. We don't really focus too much on news outside the U.S., but last week, it was trading up about $1,000 or so higher in South Korea and Japan. It was up over 12,000 at that point. And people don't realize that about 74% of the global Bitcoin trades are from South Korea and Japan, especially in Japan. They're using it quite a bit in terms of we've now got you on the phone. Let's see. In terms of quite a bit in terms of actually purchasing stuff that's a threat to the central banks. And that's why there are so many efforts to try to undermine it. Go ahead.
Yeah, so in September, I was supposed to give a talk in Beijing at BitCan, one of the largest Bitcoin conferences. The week before, China shut down the exchanges and made ICOs illegal, which was the topic of my talk. Had I shown up, I would have been arrested. The entire conference was moved to Hong Kong. Oddly enough, every keynote speaker that was to speak at that conference showed up in Hong Kong, and almost everybody who had registered. That shows the dedication. But let me get back to what we were discussing earlier. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that governments can do to shut down Bitcoin. Now, they could stop me from showing up in Beijing. I'm a human being. They could stop me at the airport and arrest me. They cannot stop and did not stop trading in Bitcoin or any other cryptocurrency. It is impossible for a government to stop a distributed system like Bitcoin. And now
that's right. It actually went up, didn't it, in terms of the amount of Chinese yen buying a Bitcoin. It went up from 5 to, I think, to 20%. Then it went back down to like 13%. Yes. But it actually is still two or three times what it was before they prohibited
it. What it was before. So prohibition requires enforcement. How do you enforce people not using Bitcoin? You would have to have an agent for every citizen within your country. They would have to come into your house and monitor your computer usage 24 hours a day. It is not possible. You cannot enforce any of these bans. And this is what governments do not understand. Banks are more terrified than governments. Governments are going to lose revenue if they're taxing income. Banks are going to lose their entire business. Because a wallet is a bank. End of story.
So do you see the banks trying to offer, and this is what a lot of people talk about, we see Venezuela is coming out and saying that they're going to offer a cryptocurrency. Interesting enough, because in Venezuela, they're one of these states like Zimbabwe and others where people are trying to flee the country with their capital. That's been one of the things that is so attractive about something like Bitcoin. And so now they're trying to come out and say, we're going to run a cryptocurrency for people. I think that's too little, too late for Venezuela. Other countries have talked about going into competition with Bitcoin, like China and Russia as well.
Yes. But you cannot, because these cryptocurrencies that governments are offering are centralized. It's just like things are now. They have central control. They can control the price. They can control the fluctuations. They can control interest rates. No, Bitcoin is not centralized. It belongs to the people. It has taken power away from centralized governments and banks and given that power to the people. When a government issues its own cryptocurrency, they're missing the point. They're simply taking that power back. Are you going to accept that? I'm not. Go ahead and issue a cryptocurrency. America, England. I don't care. I'm not going to use it. I'm going to continue to use Bitcoin.
That's right. And then when you look at efforts like China and now being reported UK, as a matter of fact, last week, some reporter pitched out a question to President Trump. What about Bitcoin? Well, we got Homeland Security looking into it. If China, if the United States, if UK try to put restrictions on people taking money in and out, we still have places like Japan that are going to, or Switzerland, that are going to run into this and say, embrace it, and people will still be able to get their money in and out through those currencies, wouldn't they? If they wanted
to. Absolutely. And again, the exchanges are now moving to distributed wallets. There is no more central exchange in the new paradigm of Bitcoin. Exchanges, you will be part of a distributed exchange. If someone shuts you down, it's not going to shut the exchange down because the exchange is spread across millions of nodes, millions of users, millions of wallets. So there's nothing technologically, legally, legislatively that can be done to stop or even impede the growth of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies.
Now, you're talking about a distributed wallet. That's something that many of us don't know about, including myself. Tell us a little bit about a distributed wallet and how does that compare to, like, say, a hardware wallet where the keys and everything reside on a separate device?
When I say distributed, I mean wallets that are including a distributed exchange. Instead of having an exchange which is located in one country with massive servers,
That exchange is now distributed among millions of users of the cryptocurrency. So you cannot take it down. The exchange process itself, if you want to exchange Bitcoin for Ethereum, there is no central exchange. It's done with everybody's wallets communicating simultaneously. It cannot be taken down. It cannot be located. It does not exist in any one location. It is an idea made manifest through millions of people accepting and embracing the idea. So when that happens, give up government. End of story. War over. People won. Government lost.
That's a great idea. Now, in the past, you've talked about the necessity, and we've heard it as well from Kim.com, the necessity to have some kind of a replacement, perhaps, for the internet that would allow us to escape the approaching centralized control that the government's always trying to exercise over this. If something like that were to come up, it would be easy to move the cryptocurrencies over to that exchange as well, wouldn't it? That new internet.
And there are thousands of people working on this, and it will happen. And the internet itself will then become distributed, starting with local nodes where you're in a town like Lexington, Tennessee, where I am, and everybody in that town has a local internet connection between each other. And then that town will connect to the next town. And then one state connects to the next, and one country connecting to the other. All of them decentralized, no central control, no ownership. Nobody is the boss of that internet, and it's coming. We all know it's coming.
That's great. That's, I think, the real hope of humanity. Not that we're ever going to be able to audit the Fed, not that we're ever going to be able to shut down it or central banks, but that we would transcend it with new technology, with new cooperation, as we're doing with Bitcoin, that as the government and as these big multinational corporations like Google and Facebook, these constructs that work with the government, as they start to exercise control, as they start to take away our freedom of speech, our freedom to exchange information with other people, that we have these new constructs that come about that will replace the old DARPA-designed internet that we have that the government has been working on decades to try to take it down.
Yes.
All right, we've got to take a quick break. Yeah, we've got to take a quick break. We're going to be right back. We're talking to John McAfee. Hey, folks, freedom is breaking out. And the most hopeful thing about this is we don't have to go begging to our masters for this. We can create the new infrastructure for this, as financial as well as informational, to transcend them, to go around them, to make them irrelevant. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're going to talk to John McAfee one more section. I'm David Knight. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm David Knight, and we're talking to John McAfee about cryptocurrencies. And we're going to talk about some other cryptocurrencies besides Bitcoin. But before we get to that, John, I want to ask you about one more thing here. And that is something that was brought up in an article on Zero Hedge talking about the fundamental values in terms of a storage of wealth. And by that, they mean people will store values in high denomination paper money. And in the same way, people are storing money in Bitcoin. We see the investment speculation that's going on there, and that's the noise that we see on top of all this. But at the bottom of that is the basic way that you use money, and that is, of course, to buy and sell things, but as a way to store wealth and to transport it to other countries. I have a feeling that a lot of the unrest that we're seeing in a lot of these third world countries, whether it's Zimbabwe or Venezuela or maybe even in Saudi Arabia, a lot of that may be driving people to put their money not in $100 bills that can get quite bulky to move around, but in some cryptocurrencies. And they point out that if you look at the total value of what's out there, they say about $1.1 trillion of $100 bills that are not counterfeit in global circulation. If you add in the counterfeit stuff and everything, you're probably about $1.7 billion. So they look at it and they say right now, Bitcoin's share of that portable storage of wealth market is about 8%. And all cryptos combined, it's only about 15%. They said if Bitcoin were to go to 20,000, they would only be 14% of that market share. If it were to go to 100,000, that would only be 33% of that. So that's an important part of this, isn't it?
It is indeed. And I did factor that into my calculations. Now, let's talk about value. What is the value of a $100 bill? Isn't it just the paper that it's printed on?
That's right.
My company, MGT, is one of the largest Bitcoin miners outside of China. It cost me almost $2,000 to create one Bitcoin.
Wow.
One Bitcoin. That's an electricity cost, management cost, cost of machines, amortized. So I know the value of a Bitcoin because we work hard to create them. So what's the value of one Bitcoin? It's got to be at least what it costs me to create one. What's the value of a $100 bill? 5 cents worth of paper, possibly, and ink.
That's right. So, and a decision by the Federal Reserve Chair to decide, hey, let's print some more of these things. Yeah.
Let's print some more of these things.
Yeah.
So let's talk. There is real value to cryptocurrencies. It takes work and time, electricity, software, and a lot of intelligence to create one coin. So surely I must think there's value in it, else we would not spend the money to create these coins.
Sure.
So there is inherent value just in the work, the proof of work, to create a single coin.
All right, let's talk about some of the other cryptocurrencies, here, because you're pointing out that this is a, you're talk, they have the metaphor of mining because it's really work that has to be done. And when we look at all these wild fluctuations, we understand that on top of the monetary aspects of these cryptocurrencies, there is speculative investment. People like to say, well, you know, the tulip bulb bubble or whatever, or talk about the real estate bubble that we had in the early 2000s. But of course, that was created by who? The Federal Reserve, the government, the banks, and so forth. They don't talk about that too much. They always want to go back to the tulip bubble thing because that's too close. And that shows that they were the ones who created that bubble and burst it. Let's talk about the other cryptocurrencies, because when you talk about the fact that we have a limit to the number of bitcoins, 21 million, four of them have disappeared, so that leaves us a 17 million of those. The other part that would come in terms of, you know, we're not going to be able to have any more of that in terms of gold, but we could have other cryptocurrencies. How does that work into the whole calculation here?
Well, there are thousands of cryptocurrencies now, literally thousands. Mm-hmm. The top are things like Ethereum, Litecoin, Monero. Of those, Monero is the one that needs to be watched the closest. And here is why. The dark web is where Bitcoin first got its use. If you wanted to hire a hitman to buy illegal drugs, to get a live tiger from the jungles of Asia, you would pay in bitcoins, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Now it's 100% Monero. Why? Mm. Because Bitcoin can be unwound. With enough computing power and enough will, like if the FBI wanted to, they could find out who a person was in the specific transaction.
With That's right. Monero, go back the blockchain. They could go all the way back to when you first got into the system. Yeah.
Yes. But with Monero, it is impossible. Utterly impossible. It is completely anonymous and completely private. So that is why in the dark web, everybody's using Monero. But what I have discovered is what starts in the dark web in terms of cryptocurrencies leaks out into the world of light, the world of above board business. Because all people, I believe, all people would like to have anonymity and privacy in terms of their financial transactions. And if I'm right, then Monero bears watching very closely.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you look at what's happening now. You have Coinbase and others now require that you send them pictures of your driver's license and so forth. So we're getting, you know, the government regulations in that way to the back door. And I think you're absolutely right. There's a lot of value, and people are realizing the value of privacy and anonymity, whether or not they're involved in anything that the government wants to do.
Yeah,
I think that's why they came after Ross Ulbricht and Silk Road so heavily. You know, the coins, I just saw an article from Free Thought Project, the coins that they stole from Ross Ulbricht and Silk Road are now worth $1.74 billion. Isn't that amazing?
Yes, it is. And they did steal them. They did steal them.
Mm-hmm.
And Ross Ulbricht is a special case. I do not think that that's going to happen again, because Bitcoin has now almost universally been accepted as, okay, it's above board, it's open, it is a currency, people are using it, and you're not going to stop it. Monero when Monero hits the light, and it has in many cases, we're going to have a serious problem with governments, because there's nothing that a government can ever do to determine who is doing what. And this scares governments, obviously. It does not scare me. I think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread.
That's great. Well, and you know, the only thing that I would be concerned about, and I hope it does succeed, I see them coming after people like Ross Ulbricht. I see them coming after people like Kim.com, just like they came after Martha Stewart or Michael Flynn. They get somebody that they want to punish for political reasons, or they want to make an example of. And that's the key thing there. So Monero is what you're looking at now as most optimistic in terms of cryptocurrencies, because it provides a different level of anonymity that they cannot walk back like they can walk back the blockchain on Bitcoin. Is that correct?
That's correct. And if Bitcoin does have a competitor, or will have, it will be Monero.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Well, that's valuable information that people can take to the bank. You know, one of the things that they were talking about in this Free Thought Project, and I'm sure you would appreciate this as well, John McAfee, they were saying that when you look at what was happening on the dark web, you look at what was happening on Silk Road, people were able to buy drugs from their living room rather than getting out on the streets. They were going through, it was basically like eliminating all the negative side effects of prohibition, which is what I have a problem with. It. I don't support drug use, but prohibition has its own set of problems in terms of corrupting law enforcement, in terms of crime and criminal gangs that are fighting each other. And what it did was it turned it into a peaceful market of exchange. You still had the drug problem that was still there. But these other activities that were regulated unreasonably, prohibition never works, whether you're trying to prohibit marijuana or beer or something else. It never works. It just creates crime. It creates corruption in government. And so the benefit of that was that it made things more peaceful. And they came after him for creating a website. Your comment on that. Giving life in prison, multiple life sentences.
First, I would like to say that it is impossible to regulate what a person chooses to do with their own mind and their own body. It has been proven over and over. If you want to drink alcohol, prohibition is not going to stop you. It's just going to make it go underground and cause problems. If you want to smoke weed, if you want to take any kind of drug, you will do so. Nothing can ever stop it. And we should have learned this. Legislation does not work when it reaches the point of what you want to do with your own body.
That's right. Well, I think this has been a very hopeful interview. I think anybody who is of a liberty mindset, a libertarian orientation, who wants to see privacy, who wants to see anonymity, who wants to be able to escape these oppressive control structures that are centralized, and as they're trying to now increase their control over our free speech, our ability to pass information along, all these things, Bitcoin, alternative web structures, that is the wave of the future. And that is, I think, the greatest, most hopeful thing that I see that's developing right now.
Absolutely, sir. Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much. It's been very interesting talking to you. And thank you for joining us. I know that you're not feeling well, and I really do appreciate you making the extra effort. Who is McAfee.com? And you can find John McAfee on Twitter at Official McAfee. Thank you so much for joining us, John McAfee.
You're welcome, sir. Thank you.
All right, stay with us. Be right back. I'm David Knight.
Disinformation. It's your host, live and uncensored, David Knight.
Welcome back. I'm David Knight. I was very encouraged by that interview with John McAfee. Freedom is never given. It's always taken. And we can take our freedom. We need to do it in the political arena. I think we need to stop begging Washington to give up its power. That is a fool's errand. I would never run for federal office. What a waste of time, in my opinion, because they're not going to give up their power. They never will. It has to be taken. And we have to take it by getting people activated at the local and state level to say, this isn't your authority. Your charter document, the Constitution, says that you don't have these powers under the Ninth and Tenth Amendment. and we're not going to surrender them to you. And those that have been surrendered in the past by neglect, by ignorance, by quislings who have turned this over to you, we're going to enforce the letter of the law. And we're going to take these powers back. Let me give you an example of this. We have the Justice Department now arguing for cell phone tracking, this cell phone tracking case that is being argued before the Supreme Court, Carpenter versus the United States. And we look at these oral arguments going back and forth. It is also hopeful in terms of the Fourth Amendment, the questions that were asked by Sotomayor and the new Supreme Court justice that President Trump just appointed, Neil Gorsuch. And we have to understand that this is something that was surrendered a long time ago to the government, creating the idea that, and this goes back to wired telephones. Remember those old things that had wires that went into the wall and then down the telephone poles and so forth to a central location? That's kind of centralized control. The idea that because you did business with a telephone company, then that any information that they passed through their fingers then became their information, even though it was your own private information. And they have extended this in principle to spy on people on the internet, to spy on people with their cell phones, to say that because you're using a cell phone provider or because you're using the internet, that you should know that you don't own this data anymore. Anything that they're able to get from you, anything they're able to demand from you, anything they're able to glean from you, they can then turn over to the government without a search warrant because it's their information about you. Now, I disagree with that approach. I disagree that people even consent to that. You look at these complicated agreements, licensing agreements that you have to sign to use these software services. Nobody reads that. Most people were totally unaware of what was going on until they saw the Ed Snowden documents. I don't think most people really understood what was happening with it. I think many people are still foolishly apathetic about it. We've been talking about it a long time here at InfoWars, but most of the general public didn't really realize, really, they're doing that? I mean, back in 2000, we had people like William Binney, Thomas Drake, other NSA whistleblowers, Wearby and others, warning us what they were doing. Nobody paid any attention to them. It got more attention with Ed Snowden. But let's take a look at what's going on with the Fourth Amendment, because this is something that has been there for decades. FreedomBunker.com points out fans of the Fourth Amendment got a rare treat at the U.S. Supreme Court during oral arguments. Both the liberal and conservative sides of the bench delivered a thorough pummeling to the government lawyer charged with defending the practice of warrantless cell phone data collection and tracking. Justice Sonia Sotomayor said, "Most Americans, I still think, want to avoid Big Brother." She said this to the lawyer who was representing the government calling for warrantless searches. She said they want to avoid the concept that government will be able to see and locate you anywhere you are at any point in time. She went on to say the Constitution protects the rights of people to be secure. Isn't it a fundamental concept, don't you think, that that would include the government searching for information about your location every second of the day for months and months at a time? And then you had Neil Gorsuch, who was even better. And we're going to give you the rest of that when we come back, because we want our radio stations to hear this as well. I'm David Knight. We'll be right back, and we have a guest coming up in the next hour as well. So stay with us. Lots more to come. We'll be right back. David Knight. At the top of the hour, I was talking about the hopefulness that John McAfee gave us in terms of other structures, transcending the government control grid, transcending government corruption, government centralization. We see that with Bitcoin. People are working on alternative internet structures as we see the government and its multinational corporations that they work with trying to enact suppression, censorship, shutting down people economically, censoring people, as well as shutting down content that's being shared. And one of the things that is been a hallmark of the 21st century, but this is something that happened 30, 40 years ago, at least. And that was using the idea that if a third party has information about you, then the government doesn't need to get a search warrant. You know, the Fourth Amendment says that you're to be secure in your person, your house, your papers, your effects. Oh, but it doesn't say anything about phones, does it? It doesn't say anything about cell phones, does it? It doesn't say anything about computers, does it? I think that finally, maybe some of these people are starting to see through this. I just read you what Justice Sonia Sotomayor said as she was questioning the Department of Justice lawyer that was defending warrantless cell phone data collection. Had some sharp questions for him. So the Constitution protects the rights of people to be secure. You need to get a warrant, don't you? Isn't it a fundamental concept, don't you think, that that would include the government searching for information about your location every second of the day for months and months at a time? Yeah, that's right. But the government created monopolies like Google and Facebook. We had the CIA's InQtel venture capital firm help to fund their creation for precisely this reason. And of course, when you have government-granted monopolies like the cell phone companies enjoy, just like AT&T used to enjoy and so forth, when you have these companies that have a very lucrative business structure, they're not going to jeopardize that by standing on principle. You might have a local provider of email who refuses to turn over Ed Snowden's emails out of principle and even shut down before he will turn that over. But you're not going to see AT&T or Verizon or Google or Facebook. They're not going to shut down, or Apple. They're not going to shut down to keep from violating your privacy. We just saw Apple and Google saying, we share the values of the Chinese communist government that wants to enact, not only enact a firewall to keep information from being exchanged in China, but they also want to push their control structures to other countries as well. And we're with them on that. We share those values with them on that. They want money. And so when they talk about PPP, private-public partnerships, they're really talking about power and profits and throwing away all principles. But it was very encouraging to see the Fourth Amendment questions that these Supreme Court justices, Sonia Sotomayor and Neil Gorsuch, who was just appointed by President Trump, Neil Gorsuch said, it seems like your whole argument boils down to if we get it from a third party, like a cell phone provider, we're okay, regardless of property interests, regardless of anything else. But how does that fit with the original understanding of the Constitution and of writs of assistance? And now listen to this. This is the key thing, because Neil Gorsuch puts this in a broader context. This isn't simply about, okay, you're broadcasting information out there, and so it's just free for the taking for the government. They can eavesdrop on you at will. He says this about writs of assistance. Neil Gorsuch said to the lawyer arguing for the Justice Department, you know, John Adams said one of the reasons for the war was the use by the government of third parties to obtain information. The British forced those third parties to help as their snitches and their snoops. Why isn't today's warrantless cell phone snooping, Gorsuch demanded, why isn't that exactly what the framers were concerned about? We've been warned by William Binney. Who knows how this is being used? Who knows what they're doing? He has said multiple times in the show when I've interviewed him, he said, we're not becoming the Stasi, the East German secret police state. We're already there. We passed that point a long time ago. And this is far worse than anything that the East German Stasi ever had, because the tools that are available to the surveillance state are far more powerful. And so you have to understand that when we look at what's happening with President Trump, when we look at what happened with Michael Flynn, the very fact that the FBI was able to quiz him over and over and over again, not only to find, to try to trip him up in an inconsistency, but because they had been watching very carefully what interesting people, as Michael Hayden says, they don't look at bad people, they look at interesting people, as I played for you earlier. Interesting people like President Trump and his entire transition team, they're looking for them, looking with a microscope at everything that they're doing, collecting information, and then coming back and using that to entrap them. That is the power of the politicized surveillance state. That is why we need to have these Fourth Amendment protections. And the people who need these Fourth Amendment protections more than anybody are the interesting people, the people who could put this in place, that people like President Trump needs to stand with the principles that this country was founded on and needs to shut down this Stasi-like police state that has been erected by people like Barack Obama and George W. Bush and Bill Clinton and others, but especially W. and Obama. W-N-O. Woe to us. W-O. If we do not turn this over. And so he says, as I say on Freedom Bunker, this is where they had the exchange going back and forth. In other words, after charging the government lawyer with ignoring the original meaning of the Fourth Amendment, Justice Gorsuch then all but accused that lawyer of dishonoring the memory of John Adams and the foundations, I would add, the foundations and the principles of this government was founded upon. We're founded on the principle of individual liberty. And if we throw that away in order to get safety and security, the promise of safety and security, we'll never get safety and security. Slaves are never secure. Slaves are never safe. Slaves are never prosperous. Don't throw away your liberty. Don't throw away your birthright for a bowl of porridge, as Esau did. Don't do that. That is beyond foolish. And we have been doing that. And it's time to take it back. It's time to roll this back. That's why I say the real approach to freedom is going to come when we take back our birthright at the local and the state level, when it is a grassroots rebellion. It's not going to be a top-down thing. You're never given your freedom. And we hope that it doesn't have to be a war. And that's one of the things I found was very encouraging about what John McAfee said. That would not require a physical war. It would require simply that we have people who come up with structures that are smarter than the people that are running this country. But we're going to need to have people of principle. We're going to have people like Judge Roy Moore, who says your rights don't come from government. Your rights are natural rights. Whether you believe in God or not, you possess them as an individual, as a human. If you don't have freedom, you don't have dignity as a human being. Those are things that you possess as a human. That was the basis for our revolution and the basis for the foundation of our country. And we have to get back to that. Look at how Chuck Todd at MSNBC was absolutely incredulous that Judge Roy Moore would say that our rights come from God, not from government. If they come from government, they're privileges, they're not rights. And again, it's amazing to see the parallels between Roy Moore and Clarence Thomas. These he said, she said attacks against somebody who has the audacity to say that government is not God. That was the big problem that Joe Biden had with Clarence Thomas. It was the problem that the establishment had with Clarence Thomas was the idea that he would say, you have such a thing as natural rights. Joe Biden called him on the carpet for that. How dare him say that a human being possesses natural rights? You don't have anything that the government doesn't give you. That's what Joe Biden was pushing against Clarence Thomas at the time. And all this stuff about Anita Hill, I believe Anita Hill, all the buttons that everybody's, she showed herself to be a total fraud within less than 2 years after that, as she supported Bill Clinton, even though he was accused of violently assaulting and raping multiple women, she supported him because she liked his politics. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're going to talk to Ted Hayes. I'm David Knight. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm David Knight, and we're going to be talking to Ted Hayes. He's a member of the Project 21 Black Leadership Network. We're going to talk to him about issues of race. We'll get to him in just one moment. Before we do, real quickly, I want to tell you about some of the sales that we have continued for the last week since last Cyber Monday. If you remember, we had a 34-hour broadcast. We called it Know Your Enemy, What You Need to Know About Fake News. Boy, we picked a bombshell week for fake news, didn't we? The bombshell news that everybody picked up and ran with on Friday so that nobody would pay any attention to the massive tax cuts that finally got through the Senate, albeit with some modifications that we don't like. But, hey, it's going to go through one way or the other. And that was a big deal. But they shut that down with all the fake news from ABC saying that there was some new revelations coming out of the Michael Flynn that they'd flipped him after accusing him and he pled guilty to lying. It was nothing new. This was stuff that we knew all along. It was not a crime. It took place only a couple of weeks before the inauguration. It took place more than 2 months after President Trump was elected president. And we already knew that the Trump administration was trying to hit the ground running. He had already contacted multiple CEOs of multinational companies talking about creating jobs, bringing jobs back to America. We'd had a lot of announcements even before Thanksgiving. So it's not unusual that they would also be trying to make contacts with other foreign governments and even people like Leon Panetta and the State Department representative that they talked to at the time. So there's nothing here, nothing here at all. Leon Panetta now says this is maybe unusual. Yeah, unusual because most presidents don't really care about trying to get things done. But we're going to be going to Ted Hayes in just one moment. Before we do, I want to tell you about some of the products that we still have on sale. The sale that began was Black Friday and then hit big time on Cyber Monday. We kept adding stuff to it up till Cyber Monday. We've extended those specials. 50% off a wide variety of products at InfoWarsStore.com as well as free shipping. Things like Emmerich's Essential Products, the entire line of household organic products that we have, 50% off. InfoWars Life Select Survival Food, 50% off. And free shipping. Big savings on that. Survival Shield X2 Nascent Iodine, Super Male Vitality, Knockout, our all-natural sleep aid. All of those, 50% off plus free shipping. Living Defense, Prostaguard, Brain Force Plus, all of those, 50% off plus free shipping. And Silver Bullet, Colloidal Silver, 67% off plus free shipping. Take a look at the sales that we have at InfoWarsStore.com. We appreciate your support. That's how we run InfoWars. That's how we're able to add new programs like the one that you're listening to. All right, let's go to Ted Hayes now. As I point out, he's a member of the Project 21 Black Leadership Council. He's best known for his activism locally in Los Angeles. He has helped the homeless. He has provided initiatives and empowerment among the homeless population of Los Angeles. One of the things I think is interesting here on his resume is that he created an innovative dome village, a great way to build housing, is with domes. It's one of my favorite things. It's always been kind of a hobby of my family, playing around with domes. So we'll talk to him about that. Mainly we want to talk about race. He's part of the Capitol Hill National Caucus, a group that opposes amnesty for illegal aliens, because of the negative effect the influx of immigrants can have on jobs and on homelessness. You can find him at nationalcenter.org. So joining us now is Ted Hayes. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Hayes.
Thank you, Sir Knight. How are you, sir?
I'm honored. Thank you. I'm good. And, you know, when you're talking about the negative effect that an uncontrolled influx of immigrants can have on homeless people, I immediately think of what's going on in San Diego, this hepatitis A outbreak that is happening there. They're putting a massive tent there. This has been going on for several months. A lot of people have died. Hundreds have been infected. And it's really kind of hit the homeless people because we can't screen people even for disease as they're coming across the border, can we?
Yes, sir, you're absolutely right. And I'm surprised that we have not been hit with a greater contagion earlier. But if we don't address this issue correctly, we're in serious trouble as a nation. Very serious trouble.
More
than we realize.
I agree. And you know, as we look also at the sanctuary city, San Francisco, and the Kate Steinle case, and we see the same thing happening in New York, it's amazing when we look at what's going on with MS-13 there, how they're targeting Hispanic youth who have come in, many of them illegal themselves. But if we don't have control of the border, these people who are fleeing violence and fleeing MS-13 in their home country, there's nothing to prevent MS-13 from following them into all the way up into New York and onto Long Island or coming into California as well.
That's absolutely correct. And the Hispanic Latino people are suffering more under these gangs than everybody else because they have their neighborhoods kind of held hostage. As it
That's
were.
Right.
And they're hiding right. behind the leftist ideology of sanctuary cities, that they are untouchable. That's got to stop. And there are ways to stop. And I don't just understand why Mr. Trump won't use the power that he actually has in the 14th Amendment and the Civil Rights Act of 1866. He could put an end to it tomorrow if he wanted to. All he's got to do is arrest a few mayors and it's done.
Yeah. Exactly. And I don't understand why, as you're talking about, what they're saying, they got to do something about MS-13. We've had Attorney General Sessions say, yeah, we got to do something about it. And yet they've got these people, they got tattoos all over their face. There's no question that they're an MS-13. They're there illegally, and they're victimizing the Hispanic community, saying join or die. Or, you know, you got a rivalry because a boyfriend or girlfriend, they kill these people. And it's horrendous what they're doing to these kids, the way they're butchering them. They're not just killing them, they're butchering them and doing it in a very sadistic way, torturing them to death.
Yeah, cutting their heads off, all kinds of horrible things that they do. Yeah. You know, the problem here, though, the reason why we have not been able to stop MS-13 because of their skin color, their brown skin color. And what they do, they say to guys like you, an Anglo-English-speaking white guy, patriot guy, they call you a racist because mm-hmm. you want to force your laws. And you say, well, why am I a racist? You say, and they say, well, look at my skin color, because you treat us the way you treated the blacks. And so what happens, because black and white people in this country have not healed, have not been healed from that old racial wound that we were born with in July 4, 1776. The socialist element has taught these young people to play on the so-called white guilt of white American men. And I know there are ways that we can actually stop that, and that's what I'm working on.
And that's why I wanted to get you on, because you've got an article on the Daily Caller. The New York Times is feeding racial animosity and ignoring racial healing. Tell us about that, what they did specifically, the article that you're referring to.
Well, there's a professor in New York City at the University of New York. I forget his name fully right now. It's kind of hard to pronounce. But the point is, he said, oh, here it is, Professor Ikau Nyanka. He is a professor at the Hebrew University in New York, and he says that he's teaching his children that they cannot be friends with white children, flying in the face of what Dr. King and all of us have dreamed of. He says that you cannot trust white people. He says you can have a beer with them, maybe, and have a little party or do a little contract business agreement. But he says, but you really cannot put your heart into these people because of their history with black people, the way they treated blacks and people of color. And
wow.
This guy is well, what he's doing what the Palestinian terrorists are doing. They're teaching their children to hate Israelis and to hate Jewish people from childhood up. This is wrong.
That's right. He's taking exactly the tactics that have been used in Nazi Germany against Jewish people and then using them to foment division in this country as well. You're exactly right, Ted Hayes. We're talking to Ted Hayes. You can find him at nationalcenter.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're going to ask, is it okay to be white? We're told over and over again that it's not. I mean, we've got to do something to heal the racial divisions in this country instead of continually picking at them and exacerbating them. Ted Hayes is going to be with us. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Please, please. He's not sorry when snowflakes can't handle the truth. It's your host, David Knight.
Trying to make some sense of it all.
Welcome back. I'm David Knight, and we're talking to Ted Hayes. I want to get back to his article that appeared on Daily Caller. The New York Times is feeding racial animosity and ignoring racial healing. And, of course, it's not just the New York Times. We're seeing this happening all over universities from coast to coast. We see it at University of Connecticut. We see it in Washington universities, and we also see it right here in Texas. So it's all over both coasts and the middle. It's everywhere. It's what we're seeing. It's the environment that we now live in. We are now seeing active racism encouraged. And I'm glad to see that Ted Hayes, who's a member of the Project 21 Black Leadership Network, part of their National Advisory Council. You can also see him at nationalcenter.org, but also project21.org. Before we get back to this, Mr. Hayes, tell us a little bit about Project 21.
Project 21 was created by Amy and David Rittenauer out of their National Center for Policy Research Center, because they felt that, you know, when you hear racial incidents in the country, it's always the leftist blacks, those who are rather controlled by the leftists, and they spew that that puppeting talk that they do, those talking points, and there's no response. So what Amy wanted to do was give people like myself, black men and women in the country who have a different point of view and a love for America, to be able to stand up and counter some of the stuff that's going on. That's what Project 21 does. But we're going to get more aggressive, as I understand. We're going to start being more activists and going after people instead of waiting for them to do an article. We're going to write articles, put them out there, make them respond to us for change.
That's good. And, you know, there's a lot of black conservatives out there, but they always get shoved to the side by the establishment.
But
just take a look at what happened at the African-American Museum, where they shove Clarence Thomas aside. I think he's one of the best justices that we got there, if not the best. I don't know. We haven't seen much from Neil Gorsuch. I read some stuff that was very good earlier. But they shove him off to the side because he's a black conservative. You're not allowed to take a look at Clarence Thomas.
But David, you know, I hear that. I know the enemy is across the field. There's no question about that. We can go all day about how bad the enemy is. The reason why the enemy is getting away with this stuff is because our side is not organized. The black conservatives are just not organized into a body politic. We're a bunch of lone rangers. We're all running around here doing radio and television shows. And we're making commentation, but we're not organized. And so, therefore, when we go to an establishment to get something done, we go as individuals. But if we went as an organized body politic, you better believe they'll have to cover us, especially if we get more aggressive and do like the leftists do. They put their bodies on the line. I'm an activist. I caused things to happen. I've been thrown in jail on numerous occasions in actions of civil disobedience. Until you're willing to put your body, your name, your reputation on the line, your talk is nothing but rhetoric. That's why we're not willing.
I agree. That's absolutely right. And that's why I think it's important. You know, we see that, especially with conservatives. To a lesser degree with libertarians, they're more likely to go out there and put their body on the line or something for a principle. But as people who are conservative or libertarian, we're looking at people as individuals. We're looking at ourselves as an individual. And so we're at a bit of a disadvantage when it comes to the people who are more of a socialist or communist perspective. They think collectively. And so we've had G. Edward Griffin, the guy who talked about the Federal Reserve, said, we have to work collectively for individual liberty. And that's a hard thing for many of us to embrace, isn't it?
Well, and it should not be, because that's exactly what the Founding Fathers are trying to tell us in the first place. If you read the Constitution, the number one statement, the number one document of the Constitution is the preamble. It doesn't say I to yes. U.S. citizens. It says we the people. And if you look at the Declaration of Independence and if you look at the Constitution, you never hear the word I or me. It's always we. We are the owners of collectivism for individual liberty. Not those guys. They just stole that from us.
That's right. And it's the right of the people.
Yes,
right?
Sir.
And that's when we're talking about individual rights. They couch it in the terms of the people, the collective people, as opposed to the government that's going to try to take away those rights.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. So what we're doing is trying to get the black conservatives and Republicans to organize to a body politic. And we need to run a campaign of honesty. One of the problems that we have in our country is whenever there's a racial incident that goes down, it's always the black guys of the left telling the white guys of the right that they are racist. They need to reform themselves. And you white guys take it. You took it. It started in 1968 when Dr. King was assassinated. I never seen such a thing where white people were crying and upset over this black man being killed. Their hearts were bleeding. But instead of Jesse Jackson, the Reverend, taking the power of God to heal the wound of our white brothers and our black brothers, they agitated it and came up with this whole crazy phrase called white guilt, when in actuality, it's black guilt being fomented upon white people who are insecure about who they are in this country.
You're absolutely right. And when we look at where the term white privilege came from, that came from Bill Ayers and Bernardine Dorn and the Weather Underground. That was a Marxist tactic to divide and conquer. In Europe, they do it along economic lines. And in America, they tried that and it wasn't as successful. So they said, we've already got this division. As you pointed out,
Yes. We
have this, we need racial healing that goes back to the foundation of our country, the slavery that we incorporated in and kept for a while before we got rid of it. And so they knew that that was a division that they could pick at and they could exploit. And that's what the Weather Underground, the communist white liberals, that's what they chose to use to create division.
And they themselves are not racist, but the socialists, they could care less what color you are or what issue is, as long as they could take the issue to destroy this great bastion of capitalism and freedom. And they will use anybody. They'll use gays. They'll use the illegal aliens. They'll use animals if it will destroy this country. And see, we as black, I was saying that Johnny Reb and Billy Yank, we need to get together, man, because our country is under siege right now.
That's right. That's right. And this article that you're talking about here, the one that was put out on the New York Times, it was an op-ed piece from Ikao Yanka.
That's him.
And it was like, can my children be friends with white children? And of course, he's saying no. He's saying no, you have to pay attention to their skin color. And we've seen the same thing happening across this country with editorials that have been put out, attacks against people who are trying to speak there, just to put up the idea, put up signs, say, it's okay to be white. Just that statement there outrages the left, outrages the establishment media, outrages the universities across this country.
You know, a lot of people come into this country, so-called people of color, and they're saying that American, particularly white men like yourself, you're a bunch of racist Nazis and Ku Klux Klanners. Well, if that is the case, why the heck are they coming here? I don't remember. Exactly. Jews trying to get into Nazi Germany. They were trying to get away. What it is, my brother, is that these people are jealous of what white men have been able to accomplish in this country. Their brown, black, red, yellow men cannot do it. That's why they come here. And you white guys need to stand up and tell them, yeah, you know what? If that's how you feel about it, fine. Get the hell out of my country.
That's right. They want what we have, but they don't want the system that gave it to us. And it's not a perfect system. It just happens to be the best system, and it can be fixed. It can be refined. It's constantly being changed. But instead, as we've seen now, especially in this last year, going in and trying to tear down the foundations of the country by trying to tear down the statues and the memorials and the that type of thing, attacking the national anthem, that's what they're really after. They're going after the symbols to try to take down the foundations of this country, and they're going to throw out the baby with a little bit of bathwater here that is left here. Instead of focusing on how we can make things better, they want to focus not on the slavery that is currently going on in Libya, that was created by the policy of Hillary Clinton and the left. They want to ignore the slave auctions that are now happening.
Yes.
And other things like that, and just focus on what happened in our country 200, 300 years ago.
You know, David, I hope I can come back in the future, because we're talking in a lot of generalities right now, and I have some ideas and some ways in which we can fix this thing. For example, in 2008, were you aware that in 2008, Congress passed a resolution, a simple resolution, stating that they acknowledge chattel slavery, they acknowledge the wrongs of Jim Crow, they acknowledge the generational damage that is done, they apologize, and they call for reconciliation. Were you aware of that in 2008?
Yes, they didn't. Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Well, the African American leadership chose to keep that quiet, because they knew that if black people across the country knew that white people, representatives, had made such a statement, it would have opened up doors of communication. When I shared it out here in L.A. with young black street thug kind of dudes, I told them they were excited. They didn't believe that it was possible. See, and this guy...
That's very important. Hang on. Stay with us. We're talking to Ted Hayes. We've got one more segment, Ted. We'll be right back. I'm David Knight. And give us some specifics when we come back. We'll be right back. I'm David Knight. Welcome back. I'm David Knight, and our guest is Ted Hayes. He's a member of the Project 21 Black Leadership Network's National Advisory Council. We're going to get back to him for some specifics about what we need for racial healing. Before we do, real quickly, I just want to remind you of some of the sales we have going on right now at InfoWarsStore.com. 50% off and free shipping on a wide variety of products. I'm not going to list them out right now, but I will tell you that right now, as we come up to Christmas, is a great time to think about gift cards. And if you get a gift card at InfoWars and enter the code BONUS, we will give you 10% off that gift card. So it's something you can pass around to your friends, to your family. If they don't know anything about InfoWarsStore.com, it'd be a great introduction to them. And it's a great savings, 10% off with the gift card, as well as we've got 50% off plus free shipping on a wide variety of products at InfoWarsStore.com. Let's go back to Ted Hayes. Again, you can find him at NationalCenter.org, also Project21.org. As we're going to break, Mr. Hayes, you were talking about how we need specifics for racial healing. And I think about, you know, when I look at this, how far away we are from this. We've got all these universities out there, just like we did at the Texas University down at San Marcos. The guy writes a op-ed piece there. Your DNA, white people, is an abomination. You were not born white, you became white. I don't know what he means by that when he says that our DNA is an abomination, but it really sets them off if you just put up a sign that says it's okay to be white. So how do we get back from that? How do we get back from a system where racist has now become the FU for most of these people, and they're basically giving a free pass to people who really are racist, because racism still exists. But by using it like that, they're basically anesthetizing a lot of people to actual racism. But how do we give us some specifics for racial healing?
Okay, Dr. King said in his speech, I Have a Dream, one of the things he said, I dreamed that one day the sons of former slaves and sons of former slave owners will sit together at the table of brotherhood. Now, as I said before, whenever there's a racial crisis in the country, our side of the table of brotherhood, we always point the finger across the table. Well, the scripture says that confess your faults one to another, pray for one another, that you may be healed. And what has happened here is that we're not going back far enough in our roots. People think, black folks think that white people, Portuguese, Spaniards particularly, and other Europeans went to Africa, invaded the continent, and ran down some very nice, peace-loving, God-loving black people and put us in chains and brought us to the United States of America. Lie, lie, lie. That is not the truth at all. What the truth is this, that black people are in denial about, and our leaders are in denial about, we put ourselves on those slave ships. We was practicing slavery in Africa. We were warring against one another, not because of our skin color, because of ethnic differences. We hated one another. In fact, when the Portuguese came, they purchased slaves. That was a mistake that Christians and Jews made, was they purchased us. But the fact of the matter is, if we had not been doing what we're doing in Chicago today, back then, we would not have been on those slave ships. And until we black people in America can admit that we had just as much a role in our situation of slavery as white people, in fact, we had more of a role in it because we initiated the conversation in the first place, us and the Muslims in Africa. Until we can get black people to have that conversation, there's nothing you or the government can do to help us. And we'll continue to holler, Black Lives Matter, but we kill one another just like our ancestors did.
That's right. And that's something that happens in every group of people. That's something that happens in every culture, every nation. Here in America, you had the Cherokees, even as they were being sent on that Trail of Tears and deported from Tennessee into Oklahoma. They had black slaves. Yes. And they had a slave revolt there after they were deported. It's a human part of the human condition, and it doesn't change based on your nationality, based on your skin color. It's part of the human condition. You see it going on in Rwanda. You see it going on all over the world still at this very point in time. And so to make this just one particular group of people is not only denying the truth, but it's also a very dangerous thing. Is this Jewish guy who wrote this anti-white article for the New York Times should realize that once you pick out one particular group and you make it not only acceptable to hate them, but you also encourage hatred of them, that is a very dangerous thing that then can spread to all these other groups in time.
The other part, let me address now, at the table of brotherhood, we black folks have got to come out of our state of denial and admit our role. On the other side of the table, though, you white guys have got to realize your value. You're the ones who created the Underground Railroad that made Harriet Tubman famous. You're the ones who gave us the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment and anti-Ku Klux Klan laws. You are the ones, you lost 740,000 innocent young white boys, North and South, had nothing to do with slavery. Those guys died over and for black people. You need to start bringing it out. And I'm saying to you, David, and to all your listening brothers and sisters out there, come on, white guys, get your chin off your chest. Get your shoulder back. Get your head up. You've done some very wonderful things. And I'll tell you one more thing, David. As part of the healing process, if I get the national platform, I'm going to call some other folks in Project 21. Black people need to have a march and a rally for once in our life, not protesting what white people have or have not done for us, but saying, white people, guess what? We thank you. Thank you so much for what you have done thus far. You've come more towards us since 1968 than we have towards you. We have remained static, and that's unfair to you, and it's unfair to us, because if you are destroyed and if you fall, we're going to fall with you, and we cannot allow that.
We know, Ted, as we look at this, and we look at the monuments that are constantly being torn down to try to tear down the establishment of Western civilization, and I would say it's Christian roots. I think another part of this, as we look at the actions of people like William Wilberforce in England, who stopped, first of all, he spent his entire life working to stop the slave trade and then working to reverse slavery. And they were even able to do that in the territories that were held by the British, do that without having a war. And so he was very effective by spending his entire life educating people and never giving up on that one particular issue. And that was based on his Christian principles. And so when they come after white people, they're not just coming after white people. They're coming after the roots of Western civilization, and they're coming after Christian principles. And it was those Christian principles, somebody like William Wilberforce calling us back to our original roots of Christianity and saying, wait a minute, you've got this wrong. As Christians, we can't do this. We must not do this. And it was what William Wilberforce did that, and others like him, the abolitionists that came out of that. That was a Christian movement for the most part. There were some non-Christians in it, but for the most part, it was calling people back to their Christian roots because we were at basis a Christian society. That was the argument that they were making.
You said the key word, education. What we need to do is have a campaign of awareness where all of these facts are brought out to the general public and every medium that we possibly can. We need the president of the United States, this particular president, to give a recital news conference on the history of the Democratic Party and Republican Party with black people. We need to bring out the truth as to what really happened. And I believe when you bring this truth out, young people, white, black, brown, red, or yellow, they will come to the light of that truth. We are in trouble, folks, because we have not been as aggressive with the truth as we ought to be. We've been in a denial state ourselves.
You know, and you talk about the Democrat Party.
Oh, boy.
And we've talked many times about how they would always use racism and try to put themselves with the majority to oppress the minority and use that division there to put themselves in power. And so when it was an overwhelming white majority, they would come after the black people. And now as they look at a demographic shift, they are shifting in terms of which group they want to identify with, because they see white people, I think, as the coming minority that they can then persecute for political power. That's why they coalesce with everybody that isn't white. So it's like, everybody that isn't white, come to us and we'll make this a party. That's what really needs to be exposed, isn't it?
And yes, sir. And our campaign needs to point out the fact that it was the Democrats who held black people for 245 years in chattel slavery. It was the Democrats who created the 99 years of black codes and Jim Crow laws against black people. It was the Democratic Party who created the Ku Klux Klan. And now it's the Democratic Party that's bringing foreigners into our country, illegally, in the name of the civil rights that 740,000 innocent young white boys died for.
That's right. And they want to replace not just white people, but black people who have been here for centuries. They want to bring in other people, other cultures, other legal systems, simply because it will make them politically empowered.
Yes, sir. And if we do not open our mouth and start telling the truth and having marches and demonstrations along these lines, they will continue to outvoice us and we will lose this country. Remember what Benjamin Franklin said, we have given you a republic if you can keep it.
That's right. Well, it's been great to talk to you. And again, we're talking to Ted Hayes, member of the Project 21 Black Leadership Network's National Advisory Council. Very important that people understand what is at stake here. Very important that we get back to the principles that made America great. The principles of individual liberty, the principles espoused by Martin Luther King Jr., saying that we need to judge people by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. That's exactly the opposite of what the establishment and both the political and the media establishment are telling us now. You can find Ted Hayes at nationalcenter.org, also at project21.org. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Hayes.
Hey, David, thank you. I hope I can come back and do some more. And that's a righteous beard you got, dude.
We'd love to have you back. And that concludes our broadcast for today. Stay with us. Alex Jones is coming up at 11 in just a couple of minutes. We'll be right back.